Hello, and welcome to a somber associate and affiliate cricket podcast. We began today with a pause to mark the tragic passing of two people on the cricket field this week. Phil Pughes, the Australian opener, was struck by a bouncer that split his vertebral artery. An incredibly rare injury from a ball that, while not innocuous, is still one any cricketer has faced or bowled. And as such, has so deeply affected everyone associated with the game right across the world. And yesterday, as we were recording, former Israeli captain Hillel Awaska was hit by a deflected straight drive while umpiring a local league match, and although details are unclear, seems to have had a heart attack and died. Our thoughts are with the families, players and teammates, particularly Sean Abbott, and the broader community of cricketers and supporters who've been touched by these events. Andrew?
Yeah, absolutely. It's just a pretty terrible week to be a cricket lover. Two people lost their lives in what we can only describe as freak accidents. These are mercifully rare incidents. I read there's only been, I think maybe half a dozen people killed on the cricket field in the last sort of 100 years. So it's mercifully rare, but when it happens, it's a tragedy. Any death is a tragedy, but when it's, especially with Phil Hughes, someone so young, he's about to turn 26, and he had what was looking like a very lengthy and successful career ahead of him, and it's sort of certainly brought the cricket community together. We may criticise certain people involved in cricket, everybody's reacted to this very well and with a lot of dignity. There was the put out your bats hashtag on Twitter, which I know you and I both participated in, and a lot of associate players around the world and associate teams around the world participated in, and the ICC, as much as we criticise them, did something very classy. They put out, outside of their HQ in Dubai, they put out one bat for all 105 ICC members, which we have to congratulate them for.
Yeah, it's been a difficult week for cricket lovers, but the support and for each other and in the communities has been very touching, as well as other sports. And we should mention, I think, Tom Cooper as well, who was the non-striker to Phil Hughes when he was struck, and obviously as well be deeply affected.
Yes, no doubt. It's just everybody on the ground was affected. Obviously, I think Trent Johnson would be there. He'd be the New South Wales assistant coach, former Ireland captain, and everybody involved would be deeply affected by it, and I know Cricket Australia are offering counselling to those who were there and anybody who's been affected by it within cricket in Australia, and I think that's the right thing to do, and hopefully everything will sort of come out okay from this, and cricket will continue, and cricket has continued. There was obviously on the day Hughes died, America's Division 2 started and all the games had a minute silence before them. Then there was a minute silence for the first Afghanistan UAE ODI the day after. So cricket is continuing. The appropriate respect is being paid, and hopefully things can get back to normal as quickly as possible.
Andrew, as you said, America's Division 2 started during the week and has been completed. The four teams involved were Argentina, Bahamas, Suriname and the Cayman Islands. And although the Cayman Islands is within the World Cricket League, it's been Suriname who's been the dominant performer throughout the tournament, really.
Yeah, they had a brief blip on the last day when they lost to Argentina, who ended up finishing last and being relegated back to Division 3, but they were by far and away the best team in the tournament, and so they deserved winners. And of course, as well as being promoted to Division 1, they also qualified for Division 6 of the World Cricket League.
So it was a particularly low scoring tournament by looks, Andrew. I think looking through the scorecards now, there's probably half a dozen scores over 100 out of 12 matches, which is surprising, and maybe says something either about the pitches, although normally the stadium in Florida is actually had been quite a good pitch when it was last used, so perhaps also the players are struggling a little bit?
Possibly. I'm not sure what the state of the pitch is like in Florida at the moment, or what the weather is like in Florida at this time of the year. It is, even in Florida, quite late to be playing cricket. And maybe it's something to do with the quality of the teams as well. You look at you mentioned Suriname, by far the best team. I think half of those scores over 100 are by Suriname, and they had the highest team score of 140-odd in one of their games. And so maybe the quality of the players is coming into that a little bit. It's sort of hard to say. The bowlers were bowled reasonably well. There was, I think, 2 or 3 5 wicket hauls during the tournament. But yeah, maybe it's a mixture of a few things: the poor quality of the batsmen and the perhaps the poor quality of the pitches and the conditions.
Argentina's still continues to slide, I think, is probably the other thing. I mean, you just mentioned they were relegated, but this is another relegation on top of quite a number of relegations for them.
Yeah, it's becoming almost cliche now that Argentina get relegated from the tournament, and Suriname have definitely taken over their title as the leading cricket nation in South America, and it's very strange. The Argentinian decline is one of the real sad things about associate cricket in recent years. In 2007 they were as high as World Cricket League Division 2, and they've just dropped down. They were essentially one of the top 20 sides in the world, and now they just dropped like a stone, and you wonder what's going on over there. Why aren't the new players coming through? And they've got a good cricketing background there. They have 3 grounds of turf pitches. They've got the facilities. They have coaches. They have some professionals coming over from test playing countries sometimes. And there's every reason for them to be a successful cricket playing country, but they're just on this seemingly terminal decline.
They're a much larger nation in population terms than the ones they're playing against, particularly the Cayman Islands, obviously. So they should be able to muster the resources if they worked on the development to be higher, but they're now in a position where they need 2 promotions just to get back to World Cricket League, which means they're really looking at sort of 4 years being away from that. And the other thing is, I think it's quite sad for the ICC because they're really the only team that's Spanish-speaking and has a link to that part of the world within the higher echelons of cricket when they were there.
In many ways, it goes back previously as well. Argentina were perhaps one of the best teams in the world between the 2 world wars, and in many ways Argentina represents a greater loss to cricket than the USA. So Argentina could have been the gateway to cricket in South America, and then more recently, obviously, popularising cricket in a large Spanish-speaking country could have gone a long way for moving out into other Spanish-speaking countries in South America, and it's a real shame to see what's happened to Argentinian cricket.
And a final note, this was a very poorly publicised tournament. We didn't preview it before the last episode because we didn't realise it was on until, I think, 2 days before, which some of the scorecards also look a bit dubious with players bowling more than 4 overs in matches, which hopefully didn't actually happen. So, again, ICC America's struggling to promote the game well in some simple senses.
It came just after the East Asia Pacific Trophy, which we were about to talk about, and that was promoted so well, and it was quite a huge contrast. ICC East Asia Pacific were publicising that weeks before it was happening. There was a full brochure published. There was, they had a tournament theme song that was put on YouTube, which all the players mimed to in the video, and it was publicised so well, and then this was just almost an afterthought. It wasn't publicised at all, really. There's nothing about it on the ICC homepage. There is something about the East Asia Pacific tournament. These are World Cup qualifiers, and they deserve to have more publicity. And you're quite, who's to blame? Is it people at the ICC headquarters in Dubai, or is it people at the ICC Americas headquarters in Toronto? And who is to blame? And maybe it's a case of six of one and a half dozen of the other. And we'll probably talk about this again and again in future episodes. But the promotion of cricket below test level, especially once you get below the top associates, certainly leaves an awful lot to be desired.
Let's move on to ECI Asia Pacific, because you just mentioned it, and as you say, it was a well-publicized tournament and a very good tournament by the looks of things. They had eight nations involved. The only nation not there was Korea. I'm not sure if you found out why. I know you asked the ICC East Asia Pacific on Twitter.
They never got back to me. I'm hearing rumours that after the Asian Games, about half of the team have given up playing cricket. The support from the Korean Olympic Committee has gone. And then there's a bit of a dust up between the Korean Cricket Association and the Korean Cricket League, and nobody really knows what's going on. And from what the rumours I've heard, it wouldn't surprise me to find out that Korea could be put on notice at the next ICC meet, which is very unfortunate, considering they performed so well in the Asian Games.
On the plus side, though, eight teams is a slightly easier tournament to fixture, because you can play four games at once and not have any buys. So that was the format. I think it's fair to say that the teams involved were fairly. There was a fairly large gap between the best and the worst. Obviously, the best team in the region is Papua New Guinea, who still have to qualify through to the World 2020 qualifiers through their local region because they didn't come in the top six. And though their net run rate, I think, probably reflects how much better than their local region they are at the moment, how big they are for their region, because it was 6.14 positive across the seven games that they played. Liga Siaka smashed a couple of scores that, if there had been more runners to chase, he might have even scored 200 in one of his games. He was going along so quickly. I think we also probably saw that Japan, Indonesia and Cook Islands were a bit below, particularly Indonesia and the Cook Islands, and the Vanuatu, Fiji and Samoa were, as probably expected, fairly evenly matched.
I think the only real surprise in this was the Philippines, who finished ahead of Japan and Indonesia and the Cook Islands. I think the last time they played an East Asia Pacific regional event, I don't think they won a game. And in this one, they beat three teams we just mentioned, Japan, Indonesia and the Cook Islands, and a very good tournament for them to finish fifth. Vanuatu, confirmed that they've passed Fiji. Fiji were for a long time second behind Papua New Guinea, and I think now that's Vanuatu. And Samoa are sort of catching up to Fiji as well, although Fiji did win the gap match between the two teams. Samoa are certainly closing in them. Samoa have had a lot of work done locally in recent years, and but in general in the East Asia Pacific, if Papua New Guinea are playing in a tournament, Papua New Guinea are winning the tournament, and such has been the case for going on for more than 35 years now, I think.
Yeah, I think it should be added, though, that from what I'm gathering, that we are actually seeing improvements from the other nations. It's not that they're stagnating.
Oh, yes. Just
that Papua New Guinea has taken to this new level and are doing so well that they're not only beating those teams that they were beating before, that they're really smashing them.
You're absolutely right. The investment that's gone into cricket in Papua New Guinea in the last few years is phenomenal, and they've really come on. Also, they've got ODI status now, and they'll be playing in the Intercontinental Cup and so on and so forth, and they've just come on in leaps and bounds. And it's not, as you say, that the other teams aren't improving, it's that Papua New Guinea is just improving at a faster rate, and hopefully some of that can rub off on the other teams. They can see what Papua New Guinea have done and try and emulate it.
And one other player we should mention is Riyad Khan, who was from Fiji, who took 19 wickets for the tournament, is far and away the leading wicket taker, which is good for Fiji in cricket that they've got a player there that's doing so well.
Yeah, yeah, he performed very well. I think he took 5 wickets twice, I think, during the tournament, and as you say, finished with 19 wickets in 7 matches, in which in 2020 cricket is, you know, pretty good going. It's impressive when you take sort of 3 wickets in a match in 2020 cricket, and you know he's averaged nearly 3 in a match, and so yeah, he's had a very good tournament.
Obviously, only one team was going to qualify for the World 2020 from this. However, there was a consolation prize for the other 4 teams, who only one of which already is in the World Cricket League, which is Vanuatu. So we saw Fiji, Samoa, Japan and the Philippines play off in some 50-over matches, which again is good to see that they've used 50-over matches to determine who will go into the World Cricket League. We can run through these in one by one because it's just the 3 of them. Japan was bowled out for 103 in the first match and Fiji chased it down very quickly, losing just the 1 wicket.
Comprehensive win by Fiji. They've had some more recent experience of 50-over cricket. They have played in the World Cricket League. They actually started in Division 4 before getting relegated all the way to Division 7 before that was cancelled. And they were pretty impressive in that win there. And then the other semi-final was Samoa against the Philippines. I don't think the Philippines have ever played any 50-over cricket internationally. And Samoa had Fred Sapatu score an unbeaten 133 in their innings in that match, and they won that match by 136 runs, another pretty comprehensive win in the other semi-final.
Yeah, and then in the final, which was going to determine the World Cricket League place, Samoa just didn't get it together, I guess. They were bowled out for only 73 in 23.2 overs, although at one point they were 6 for 21, so it was at least set some sort of a target, but Fiji kind of cruised to victory, just losing the 1 wicket again.
Yeah, you know, they chased down the runs in just under 10 overs. Joe Rica scored an unbeaten 51, and yeah, Fiji back in the World Cricket League in Division 6, and yeah, we'll see how they go, and hopefully they can stay in Division 6 at least, if not get promoted.
And just on Fiji, I think it's also a testament to the value of good preparation, because they, I think, had several weeks, it might even be as high as 5, moving around beforehand, going to Australia, playing games for this tournament. And, I mean, it's obviously paid off. They were behind Vanuatu, but not by a lot, but they've managed to get that World Cricket League place.
Yeah, and they weren't just playing 2020 games as part of the preparation. They were playing 50-over games. I think maybe even a couple of 2-day games they played as well. So they've given themselves that good foundation, and it's paid off, and they've done very well. And they've got a sort of good cricket board there. They've got a good coach in Shane Jurgensen, and they have the possibility of kicking on and perhaps reclaiming that second place in the region from Vanuatu. And Fijian cricket, Fiji were once the best team in the region. They were good enough to be given first class status at one point in the 1950s for a couple of tours of New Zealand. And they've had a bit of a decline in recent years, and they're looking to reclaim that place, so in the upper echelons of East Asia Pacific cricket.
So the other tournament that started just as when we recorded the last episode, Andrew, was the Asian Cricket Council Under 19 Premier League, where I think we mentioned at the time that Afghanistan were coasting through their games, and that continued. Some of the results were winning by 306 runs, by 277 runs. We also saw Nepal win by 262 runs. So it was a fairly comprehensive victory for the Afghan side, and they'll move through the Under-19 World Cup, and Nepal will be in the repechage.
Yeah, I think this sort of just served to confirm that Afghanistan and Nepal are streets ahead of their rivals, certainly at Under-19 level. And it was pretty predictable that those two teams would be in the top two. UAE came third. UAE sometimes struggle in youth cricket. UAE, as people know, is a nation of immigrants to some extent, and people tend not to move there until later on in life. So the senior team has players who moved in the early 20s, and obviously the UAE team, under 19 team, doesn't necessarily have that. But they still performed reasonably well to finish third. Malaysia finished fourth, and then Saudi Arabia fifth, and Kuwait will be very disappointed to have not won a game, especially with them having hosted the tournament.
Yeah, Kuwait and Saudi Arabia really struggled throughout. They're quite a long way behind the other two teams. Certainly, I think Malaysia will probably be disappointed to come in behind the UAE, and it's a good sign for UAE cricket that they have actually got a decent under-19 team. As you say, they're probably one of those teams that has been accused of being nothing but expats in the past, and if they're getting that program going, that's a good sign.
Yeah, if they can produce their own players, even if these are the children of expats in the UAE, and if they can produce their own players and get it so that they've got a mostly homegrown side in the future, it provides a more sustainable future for UAE cricket.
We also saw a number of matches by one-day teams over the last few weeks. The Papua New Guinea versus Hong Kong three-day game was, I think, the first of those, and it was a very good victory by Papua New Guinea. They scored 469 in the first innings. They bowled Hong Kong out for 205. Second innings was a struggle, but they were kind of chasing a declaration, I guess, and they won in the end by 133 runs.
Yeah, good performance by Papua New Guinea in the first sort of three-day match they've ever played, I think. Hong Kong have played some three-day cricket. They played in the Intercontinental Cup back in 2005, of course. And you saw Asad Vala and Vani Maria both fall just short of a century. And then the second innings for Papua New Guinea, perhaps the least said about that, the better, although Asad Vala had an interesting knock. He scored 40 from 13 balls. Although they did rejig the batting lineup in the second innings to give some other players batting experience more towards the top of the order. And then, they bowled Hong Kong out for 245, and a pretty good win for them. So Norman Vanua took 5 for 36 in Hong Kong second innings, and he removed the sort of Hong Kong upper order. Jamie Atkinson was looking well set at one point on 63, and very good experience for Papua New Guinea, and it will stand them in good stead for when they play in the Intercontinental Cup against some more opponents who have more experience of multi-day cricket next year.
Yeah, it's interesting to note that in the first innings they had 650s and no hundreds, which is, I think, in fact, 290s and four scores just over 50, which may indicate that they still need to work on their ability to build an innings and to get past milestones. Obviously, you don't have that opportunity in 2020 cricket, and to some extent, you don't even necessarily have that opportunity always in one-day cricket. So there's certainly things to work on in terms of how they go about their batting. Hopefully, the playing in the South Australian Premier League will help them with as well.
Yeah, you building an innings when the sort of development of Papua New Guinea cricket kicked off a few years ago. That was what the coaches and management pointed out as being one of their failures. They'd get 30 and then get out, and they've worked on building innings in 2020 cricket and 50 over cricket, and now they need to work on building it in multi-day cricket as well. And obviously playing in the South Australian Premier League is going to help bring that on a bit, and hopefully they can maybe play some two-day or three-day matches locally as well. I know Hong Kong had played a three-day trial match shortly before this tour, and it's just try and build on, learn how to build innings. And of course, you thought the one player in the team who did know how to build innings would have been Geraint Jones, but he got out for four, so unfortunate for him. But yeah, so building innings, something they certainly need to work on. They've done it in 2020 in one-day cricket, and now it's time for them to do it in three-day and four-day cricket.
It will be interesting to see whether in four-day cricket they continue to score at 4.5 runs and over, which is unusually fast, but it will be very entertaining, particularly as well as their fielding continues to be so entertaining as well.
Yeah, and Hong Kong bowled 96 overs in that first day. You know, in an era where Test teams struggle to get through 80 overs in a day, and Hong Kong managed to get through 96 in a day, which is quite refreshing to see. And I think some other teams could learn a lot from that sort of over rate.
Sticking with Hong Kong, they went on a tour of Sri Lanka to not to play Sri Lanka, but to play Nepal. At first, they'll be playing a three-day match shortly. Unfortunately, this is not a great time of year to play in Sri Lanka. The English are finding this out as well, that they've had four matches abandoned without a ball bowled, and then managed to get 120 over match in on a pitch that had already, on a ground that had an abandoned match between England and Sri Lanka the previous day, and it was an interesting 20 over match, I think it's fair to say. Nepal being bowled out for 72, although they did last 20 overs, only thanks to Sampal Kami's 40 off 31 batting at number 10.
Yeah, which is the highest score by a number 10 in any 2020 international.
It's almost worth reading the figures before that. It goes 25205 1135, so no one else got over double figures. The beginning of the Hong Kong innings goes 8-4-0-0-0, and then we finally saw a partnership between Aziz Khan and Anas Khan, which, though they weren't necessarily batting together for much of it, but the two of them managed the only other two double figure scores in the entire game, and Hong Kong did manage to scrape across the line by one ball remaining and two wickets in hand.
Yeah, an extremely low scoring game, but I should also point out in the Nepalese, Aziz Khan took two wickets for just four runs in four overs. It's the most economical four over spell in 2020 internationals. So a couple of records in that innings, despite the low scores, or maybe because of the low scores. And yeah, it still ended up, despite the low scores, it still ended up being a pretty exciting finish, I suppose. It's not often you can say that about a game with such low scores. But yeah, good for them to actually get on the field and play a game against each other. Unfortunately, they couldn't play the full three-match series, but at least they got this one T20 international in, and it's good for them to get that under the bank, in the bank.
So Nepal did manage to play two three-day games. The first was against the Kurun Agala combined 11 that they lost by 87 runs. They struggled a bit with the bat. They managed to bowl the combined 11 out for 347, but they only made 187 themselves, and were then bowled out for 211 in the second innings to lose by 87 runs.
Nepal's first sort of multi-day match since 2006, I think, so we perhaps didn't expect them to do too well. Sampal Kami bowled particularly well. He took five wickets in the first innings, three in the second, but aside from that, there wasn't too much to write home about for Nepal. Paris Khadka scored 59 in the first innings, and then probably Rajesh Palami scored 95 in the second innings, unlucky to miss out on a century. And Nepal, though, couldn't bat out their overs and lost the game by 87 runs. But this was, that match was more about experience of three-day cricket than anything else.
Yeah, and the second match was against the Sri Lanka combined at Cricket 11, and it was a better performance. It was a very low-scoring game. Sampal Kani did well again. He took 6 for 48 in the first innings and 4 for 48 in the second to take 10 wickets of the match. They bowled the Sri Lankan 11 out for 162, made only 193 themselves. In fact, there's almost nothing there after the opening partnership. I'd managed to bowl them out for 95 in the second innings before, unfortunately, rain prevented them from chasing down the score.
Yeah, and you know, I think, as you say, a much improved performance in that second match. And you know, I know Nepal are hoping to perform well in World Cricket League Division 2 and get to the Intercontinental Cup, and if they do, this will have been, you know, good preparation for them. I get playing against not particularly experienced teams, but perhaps more experienced teams in multi-day cricket than Nepal are, and they'll have taken a lot from that, and will be able to, if they do qualify for the Intercontinental Cup, they'll be able to take that experience and hopefully perform a little better than the last time they played an Intercontinental Cup.
And Hong Kong will be, who we mentioned just before, who they'll be playing the three-day match themselves to round out their tour, which again is good to see. It was good of Sri Lankan cricket to arrange these fixtures for these teams, and particularly for Hong Kong, who haven't, as you say, haven't played a lot of three-day cricket because they'll obviously be moving us into the Continental Cup next year.
Yeah, very good of Sri Lanka cricket to organise these matches. It just would have been nice maybe it was at a slightly drier time of year.
A country that never seems to have issues with weather is the UAE, and there's been a number of matches being played there. Afghanistan's there, they're based there in some ways. There's a New Zealand A side across there as well as the New Zealand side, of course, who are playing Pakistan. And Ireland is also there, and so we've seen a number of matches between both UAE and Afghanistan and New Zealand A and all three sides. I suppose we'll start with the New Zealand A matches. They played against the UAE and defeated them by 78 runs, which I think would probably be a little disappointing for the UAE, given they were playing at home.
Yeah, I think they were disappointed, but they're playing against a very talented New Zealand A side. It includes quite a few players who have played for the New Zealand senior side, Luke Ronchi, Daniel Vittori, Kyle Mills, and a few others as well. And yeah, so they were always going to struggle, and especially after the start they had to their innings as well. Both openers were out for ducks. They were 21 for 5. Sorry, at one point it was only Shyman Anwar and, let me get this right, Karate Krishna Chandran, who really gave their innings any sort of respectability. Both of them scored half centuries. Shyman Anwar scoring 60. And so yeah, after the start, the UAE had, they were always going to struggle to chase down that target. But they bowled New Zealand A out, which is something for them to take heart from.
The next match that New Zealand A played was against Afghanistan, and again, the New Zealand A side came out the victors, this time by 105 runs.
Yeah, so, Afghanistan bowled New Zealand A out for 204. It took New Zealand, overall New Zealand A to bat out their 50 overs. And then, like with the UAE, you got off to an absolutely dreadful start. They were 35 for 6 in the 16th over. And when you have a start like that, even chasing 200, you're always going to struggle to chase the target. And sure enough, they bowled out for 99. And very disappointing performance there by Afghanistan.
Yeah, you'd hope, again, they play there so often that really it's their, practically their home conditions. So, although, as you say, it's a strong New Zealand A side, they should be able to match them in these kind of matches.
Yeah, as you say, a lot of experience playing in the UAE, and they should be more used to it than New Zealand.
We did have one victory for the associate side, though. Ireland, who came out on top in their match against New Zealand. That's quite a fairly strong Irish side. The New Zealand A was batting first again. They made 252, and we saw an excellent innings by Andy Belburney, who scored 129 off 96 balls and led the way for the Irish to chase it down.
And earlier Kevin O'Brien had bowled well. He took 4 for 39, and all top order wickets as well. He took 4 of the top 5. And, you know, this was a very strong Ireland side as well. They're missing perhaps only Ed Joyce and Tim Murtagh from their first choice 11. And, yeah, absolutely. You know, Niall O'Brien batted well as well. He scored 68. And yeah, so good to see Ireland after a sort of ropey time they had in Australia for their official preparation tour, for them to get back to winning ways and win this game quite comprehensively.
And they'll play one more match tomorrow as we're recording, so we'll talk about the next episode. Afghanistan and then playing a series of one-day internationals against the UAE. Would probably in other contexts call these pointless friendlies, but we've so far just had the one, and again the UAE's demonstrating their ability to defeat Afghanistan fairly consistently.
Yeah, it's a bit of a mystery how they managed to keep beating Afghanistan on such a regular basis. This is the ninth time they've played in a 50-over match and the eighth time the UAE have won. UAE won the first seven, and then Afghanistan managed to get a win in the ACC Premier League earlier this year. And then obviously UAE have won this game. The Afghanistan scored 2-4, 8-6, and then the UAE, they took it right to the penultimate over, but they were never really in trouble. They won by 5 wickets, and you know, Amjad Ali was 67, Andre Berenga with 52, and then Kerim Khan with 53. Sort of convincing win for the UAE in many ways, and the bad run of form for Afghanistan against the UAE continues.
And I say that there's another 3 matches in that series. There's one being played at the moment. Afghanistan seem to be doing quite well in this. They've managed to score 280 in the first innings with a century from Naras Mengel. So, but we'll talk about that in the next episode, Andrew.
Yeah, and we should probably point out it's good to see a name return to the Afghanistan lineup for that second ODI, Hamid Hassan. So hopefully he can stay fit and play in the World Cup early next year.
Yeah, he'll definitely be someone that they'll want in the Australia and New Zealand, given his pace.
Yes.
We've got one more match to report on, and Kenya is touring Namibia. They're not playing 8 2020 matches this time. It's, I think, 2 1-days against Namibia A, and or was to be 2 1-days against Namibia A and 2 1-days against Namibia. Well, I believe some visa problems caused a delay of a couple of matches, so I'm not sure what the status of that tour is in terms of the fixtures, but in the first match, Kenya managed to win. An unbeaten half century from Rakib Patel allowed them to chase down Namibia's score of 209.
Yeah, obviously, very important preparation tour for Kenya and for Namibia to some extent. Also, both will play in World Cricket League Division 2 in Namibia in January, and you know, I think that these games are more about preparation for that than for anything else. And so Kenya started with a win, and they'll be, you know, they're looking to return to the sort of top of associate cricket and qualify for the World Cricket League Championship and Intercontinental Cup, and they need as much preparation as they can get.
And speaking of players, it's good to see back in lineups. Craig Williams was back for Namibia, and he'll be a very valuable contributor for them in World Cricket League Division 2.
You know, some of these players who have been missing from the Namibian lineup seem to be coming back now. You know, Jerry Snyman's returned to the side recently as well, and now they've got Craig Williams back, and if you're putting together a good side, and you know, I think you'd probably back them to finish in the top two of World Cricket League Division 2, especially playing at home, and you know, get into that Intercontinental Cup and World Cricket League Championship.
Moving on to other news, we've seen, again, I guess it's probably not really news, that the 10-team World Cup has been confirmed for 2019.
After congratulating the ICC earlier in the episode, now is when we criticise them. And you know, we knew this was happening. There was a murmur that perhaps a good performance from the associates in the 2015 World Cup might cause a decision to be changed. But obviously, you know, whoever started that rumour was talking bollocks, and it's been confirmed the 2019 World Cup will be 10 teams. There is theoretically a qualifying pathway. Associates can qualify through the rankings, but of course, as we both know, the rankings are... ICC rankings, it's incredibly easy to game the system. The four members just don't play the associates, so that the associates can't get the ranking points, can't get the ranking points. And then when they finally play in the qualifier will be in Bangladesh. So Bangladesh will have home advantage in that qualifier. Zimbabwe will be probably playing in that qualifier. Zimbabwe playing Bangladesh a lot, and the associates don't play in Bangladesh very often because Bangladesh don't want to play the associates because it might show that they're not actually as good as they might otherwise be, might otherwise want people to think they are. It's another terrible decision, the ICC. We knew it was happening, and it's just unfortunate. I appeared on the Geek and Wild podcast with Peter Miller and Tim Wigmore talking about it, if people want to seek that out. And I think we all agreed it was possibly one of the worst administrative decisions the ICC have ever made, and it's no other sport is trying to contract their major tournaments, and with good reason. They see it as something to promote the game. With cricket, just seems to be happy with the status quo, and maybe eventually it's going to come back and bite them, and I hope it does, and to some extent. And we're a long way from anything major changing, and it's unfortunate the associates are being treated pretty crappily, really.
The most interesting thing, I think, with regard to the World Cup will be whether it exists beyond 2023. It's now of a size, despite being only having 10 teams in it, but in terms of the broadcasting requirements, it's really, in some ways, they've restricted it to the big three members, and in some ways it's only feasible in those countries as well. It's going to play in Australia this year, then England, and then India. The rumour was that India would have every second kind of tournament, which means that it'll probably end up back in Australia in 2027, but it's not clear that Australians are particularly keen on one-day cricket. They've got the lowest crowds at the beginning of this summer in more than 30 years, and it'd be hard to see whether they'd have an enthusiasm to re-host again in just 12 years' time.
Yeah, and part of you has to wonder, is that because of the repeated opponents that you have in one-day cricket now? There's Australia play South Africa quite often, they play England even more often, they play India even more often, and it's the same old stuff, and perhaps people want to see something different. And the ICC aren't planning on giving them any time soon. I did say on the... it was pointed out on the Geek and Wild podcast that I was on that India and Pakistan is a big game in the World Cup, but it's a big game perhaps because India hardly ever play Pakistan. They're not playing every 6 months anymore in tournaments in Sharjah like they used to, and they don't tour each other. India v Pakistan is such a big game in World Cups because it's still special, it's still unique, it doesn't happen very often. No other game is.
The other major news out of the ICC was that they had their award season. We've, in the past, I think, criticised the Associate and Affiliate Cricket of the Year, and there was a worthy winner, Preston Momsen from Scotland, had a very good World Cup qualifiers and quite a good year, although the nominations were, again, a little strange. Callum McLeod, Mohammad Nabi, and Samulash Chinwari all had reasonable years, but I feel that, again, they've neglected substantial portions of the cricket that goes on in the associate world, and particularly given the time frame of which the awards were run, to not actually nominate an Irishman when they won almost all the trophies seemed a little strange.
The other strange thing, I think, was the ICC 2020 International Performance of the Year, which went to Aaron Finch of Australia I think a century and just a meaningless bilateral, but you'd think, well, what about, you know, Stefan Myberg and Tom Cooper in the World 2020 in that game against Ireland? You a sort of crucial must-win game. Surely that was a better performance, but you're arguing about awards is, you know, in the, the grand scheme of things, pretty pointless.
There seems to be been a policy change, or there's rumours of a policy change with regard to umpiring, at least in ICC Europe, that they're not allowed to umpire in regional tournaments unless the cricket of the country is of a decent standard. This is a policy for Test nations, of course, and an umpire can't umpire a Test match from an associate nation, regardless of how good an umpire they are. And it's probably a slightly problematic thing for associate nations, more so, given that there's not that many umpires running around.
I heard this from an umpire from Gibraltar called Sunil Chandramani. He's a very good umpire and sort of handles himself very well in the field. It was a man-cadding incident in the ICC Europe Division 1 last year that he handled very well. And he got a bit of stick for it after it, but you know, he handled himself very well, and he's a very good umpire. And he's been told that because cricket in Gibraltar isn't of a high enough standard, he's not umpiring at a high enough standard domestically, that if he wants to carry on umpiring in ICC Europe tournaments, he'll have to move to another country, which is a ridiculous thing to have to tell an umpire. You shouldn't have to do that in order to keep your job, as it were. And you know, the development program, as well as developing teams, is also supposed to be about developing scorers and developing umpires and developing groundsmen and so on and so forth. It's not just about the players and the teams. It's about everything that goes on. You know, without the umpires, the scorers, the groundsmen, etc., you were unable to develop the players in the first place. And it seems a very strange decision. You know, just because Gibraltar aren't, domestic cricket isn't of a high enough standard to deny a talented Gibraltar umpire from umpiring. And then you look at the ICC Europe tournament panel, which was released the other week, and there's a Spanish umpire on there, and you think, well, surely the cricket in Spain isn't of as a high standard as it is in Gibraltar. But then you realise that umpire actually spends most of his time umpiring in club cricket in England, and you realise, well, you know, he's a Spanish umpire in name only, to some extent, and it's just such an odd decision to deny people the ability to develop themselves when you're supposed to be running a development program.
Other news, there's a couple of things going on in the social world. It's been relatively quiet for the most part, but Afghanistan had been playing a 4-day competition, which is fantastic for them to organise that, because even some of the full members don't have 4-day competitions. I think Sri Lanka still plays 3-day matches often, and others struggle to get their 4-day competitions to actually be run, whereas they've managed to do a 5-region competition. They've all played one game each against each of the regions, and we saw Ms. Anak region win in the final over the Spingar, although Spingar was probably the dominant team through the tournament.
Yeah, the final, to some extent, was a bit of a anticlimax. Spingar bowled out for 152, Ms. Anak scored 260, and then Spingar bowled out the second innings for just 88, and Ms. Anak won by an innings after, you know, they were, you know, Spingar had gone through the group stage unbeaten, you know, 3 wins and a draw, whereas Ms. Anak had, you know, two wins, a draw and a loss, and were 20 points behind. So Spingar will be kicking themselves that they couldn't sort of perform as well in the final as they did throughout the group stage. Very unfortunate for them, but as you say, absolutely superb to see them playing 4-day cricket as well, not just 3-day cricket, and playing quite a substantial tournament as well.
And probably pull a couple of names out to keep an eye on from Afghanistan as well. In the final, Rokan Barakzai took 6 for 34 in the first innings, and then 4 for 10 off 11 overs in the second. He took 25 wickets at only an average of 11.4 through the tournament itself. So the only information I have on him, or at least it's on Cricket Info, is that he plays for the Mizanuck region and he was has an unknown birth date. So the point of these sorts of tournaments is to unearth and develop talent, and he's obviously a potential find for Afghanistan.
Yeah, they just keep producing these players, don't they? And it wouldn't completely surprise to see Afghanistan go past Ireland in the next few years.
Yeah, and the other one I think is worth... He's played for Afghanistan before, the batsman Hashmatullah Shahidi. In three matches, scored 745 runs. He had an average of 186, 300s, a high score of 261, and a strike rate of 91. So... which is phenomenal, to put it mildly.
Yeah.
two of those innings were not out as well. I think he scored 350s in those six innings and 300s, but two of the 50s he was stranded. He's only a young player. He's obviously going to be a star as well once he gets going.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. There were some pretty phenomenal performances by a few players, and. But you know, he certainly played extremely well, as you say.
There's news of a sort coming out of Afghanistan's neighbour, Pakistan. They've been trying for a while to get teams to go there. They have slight misgivings about them trying to get associate teams to tour because they're so desperate for cricket. They seem to have organised for Kenya to go there. It had been mooted at first. During the same period that Kenya's now gone to Namibia, but it had fallen through. But it seems like that Kenya will tour Pakistan from December the 11th, playing five games between them and a Pakistan A side between the 13th and the 20th of December.
Yeah, and you know Pakistan originally tried to get Ireland to tour in September, and there was an agreement from Cricket Ireland, so there was some terrorist attacks in Karachi and in June, which sort of caused that tour to be cancelled. And you know, I think, as we said at the time, we're not too comfortable with them using associates to try and show that they can play international cricket at home. Your associates are obviously desperate for matches against high-quality opposition and will often jump at the chance when a full member might otherwise not take the risk of visiting Pakistan. And the last thing we want is for anything to happen on any of these tours, and hopefully it won't. And Kenya can get some good experience ahead of World Cricket League Division 2. And Pakistan, just as a cricket fan, I want international cricket to return to Pakistan, but I'd rather they weren't using associates, as it were, to prove that they can still host international cricket.
And also on the World Cricket League Division 2 preparation front, Uganda has organised to go to South Africa for a week in January as well. So we'll see more news about that. Nepal is struggling a little bit with their preparations because of their administrative removal of the body that runs cricket in Nepal, even if it's only temporary, which is stifling their decision making. So hopefully they will be properly prepared when that tournament rolls around. But at least Uganda's got something in the works.
Yeah, obviously all the teams are taking World Cricket League Division 2 very seriously. It's the sort of, as far as we know, the last possible chance for these teams to qualify to move along in qualifying for the 2019 World Cup, and such that they can qualify for the 2019 World Cup, and everybody's preparing reasonably well and getting in a lot of cricket to prepare, and hopefully it's going to turn out to be a good tournament.
And that's all we have in this rather sad episode. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you, Russ, as always.